Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. We are on the precipice of 2021. And as this is our first time recording in the new year, how long do you think we can call it the new year, Noel? To like just January or?
I think all year. I think until there's another new year, right? I don't know, Ben. This is a very heady question, and we're going to be asking a lot of heady questions today. We're going to be doing a lot of waxing philosophical. I totally stole that from an article that we're using here, but it's a phrase that I really love about the future. Because, you know, 2021, if ever there was a more futuristic sounding year than 2020, it was 2021, my friend. And 2020 was a garbage year. So let's forget about that. And let's move on to the real future, which starts right now.
And in today's first part of a two-part episode.
Hey.
We are partnering with our ride or die super producer, Casey Pegram, to share some predictions. Now, you know, Noel, I was thinking about this. Our pal slash nemesis, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister, has historically done a lot of prediction episodes on his show, Tech Stuff.
That's right.
It always seemed like such a gamble to me. Mm-hmm. I don't like the idea of making predictions unless you have to, but we, being a show that is both ridiculous and about history, found some just bonkers, amazing predictions about the 21st century, not from people alive today, but from the great minds of years before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, preemptively from the great beyond in our preemptive two-parter. And not only are they dead, they were in fact some great minds, some real kind of like neo-futurists, you know, before that was really as much of a thing as we think of today. We're talking about writers of science fiction. We're talking about inventors. We're talking about just a lot of great forward-thinking intellects of our time.
Yes. Yeah, so we know that predictions are a big business, right? You find predictions in the stock market. You find them in the world of tech. You find them in the world of politics, economics, and ecology. Some predictions have already come to pass. You know, the idea that the world's human population would rise over time, that seems to be true. The fact that technology would disrupt numerous industries and parts of people's daily lives, that's true, but those are very broad things. What we're bringing you here today are some specifics. And with this, who better to start our story than the one, the only, you know him, you love him, Nikola Tesla. It turns out, in addition to inventing, he made a lot of predictions.
Yeah, Tesla indeed. And he wasn't a science fiction writer. He was basically a creator of real life science fiction. Well, I guess science fact. Have you ever been to the Griffith Park Observatory in Los Angeles, Ben?
Yes, I have.
You may recall then that there is a Tesla coil there that mm-hmm. always strikes me as something right out of science fiction, probably because it's used so frequently in like, you know, mad scientist laboratory scenes. And in fact, the one that is in the Griffith Park Observatory was featured in the kind of classic Universal school of monster movies. So that's a fun thing to go see. But yeah, he was very much someone that was very functional and practical in the way he was able to kind of take these ideas that he had and convert them into real life inventions. But he also made a lot of very, let's just say, kind of bold predictions about the future, some of which were a little more on point than others. He is thought of even still today as one of the great thinkers of the modern age, but some of his predictions were super weird and niche. For example, he truly believed with his heart of hearts That in the 21st century, which is the thing they would have referred to at the time, the 21st century, this mystical future time where everything will, you know, be vastly different, people wouldn't drink coffee anymore. He thought coffee was like going to be super gauche because he looked at it as a means of poisoning oneself. Any kind of stimulants like nicotine or caffeine, he seemed like he had a personal grudge against, but he was trying to kind of read the tea leaves of like what popular society or civilized society rather would accept. And he believed that in the future, these things would be considered super passe and then no one would drink them anymore or you know, ingest nicotine.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Yeah. And just cheers to everybody listening along like me and maybe like you, Nolan, enjoying a nice cup of coffee here. It turns out as much as I love you, Mr. Tesla, you were dead wrong about this one. We are still swigging jugs of Java as though our lives depend on it. He was partially right about nicotine. Smoking rates have continued time over time to decline. But he was also super, super, super confident about these predictions. All of the ones we're telling you, there were none that he said, I don't know, I give it like a 30-70 chance. He did make one correct call about beverages in general. He said booze would still be around. He didn't think it was the same thing as like coffee. He, in fact, loved it. He called it an elixir of life.
Yeah. Spoken like a true lush. Yeah, it's true. It's funny, too, Ben. You talk about, you're right. Obviously, you know, smoking actual combustible cigarettes is super on the decline. But there's all kinds of other, you know, delivery mechanisms for people's precious nicotine, whether it's gum or whether it's, you know, the weirdly neo-futuristic vape mechanisms, which still kind of weirds me out in a lot of ways. To me, that's one of the most futury looking things that is around today is vaping. Maybe that's just, I don't know why I think that.
I like the ones that look like walkie talkies.
Yeah.
And if I see somebody, you know what I'm talking about, with the little stubby stem and the handheld thing about the size of your palm. I love that because when I see somebody with one, I always like to pretend they're a spy from, you know, the 80s or 90s before they had earbuds.
Or it's like they're smoking out of one of those super clunky, like early 90s cell phones, you know, the car phones, ones with like the big fat receivers and the giant antenna on top. But yeah, Tesla was dead wrong about the coffee and slightly less dead wrong, but still wrong about the nicotine and dead right about alcohol. People love a good drink every now and then. And he also was a really big proponent of nutrition, despite being clearly a bit of a booze hound. He was a huge fan. He wasn't a vegan exactly, but he was a big fan of like not eating too much meat. And he really liked things like milk and honey and wheat, which were ingredients shown by a gentleman by the name of Bernard McFadden to be usable in creating kind of foodstuffs that were a little more sustainable and a little more natural and would create a population that would live longer in theory.
Yeah, yeah. And this is an idea that a lot of other people shared and a lot of people share today. You know, one that always stuck out to me was Robert Heinlein, who the famous sci-fi writer, he had written things like Stranger in a Strange Land and so on. As far back as the early 1950s, Heinlein was saying beef is not going to last at the levels of consumption it's at now. Eventually, in his mind, fish and yeast would become the main sources of protein. Asimov took this even further in 1964. He said that the World's Fair of 2014 would feature algae bars and pseudo steak, sort of like, I guess the most extreme version of that would be like, sort of like those bars they're served on the film Snow Crash. No spoilers. Watch it. It's worth it. And it looks like, if you think about it, in a very vague, well, somewhat vague way, these guys were predicting the rise of things like Impossible Burgers or alternatives to meat. What are those? What is it? Is it Morningstar? Is that the brand?
Yeah, they make the fake chicken nuggets and all that. And there's like things like corn. Yeah. Like chicken nuggets made out of corn.
With a Q.
With a Q. It's got to have a Q. That's how you know it's on the cutting edge. There's a really huge billboard off of the interstate near where I live that says, "Nut milk is not milk." And if you look at it from far enough away, it just looks like it says nut milk is nut milk. But it's a big bone of contention with the milk lobby, this idea that using the word milk is a no-no when it comes to nut milk, because it's really not actual milk. And I got into a conversation with a friend of mine about this, and she brought up the fact that it's super weird that we drink the milk of other animals, and that's very unusual in life. And it's something that I think, Ben, you've mentioned before on the show, it's something we had to adapt to, like our bodies, like, you know, over time have adapted to drinking cow's milk, except for those poor souls that are lactose intolerant, right?
Yeah. It's a mutation that has not hit the entirety of the human species. It's incredibly unusual for any animal, any mammal, to drink milk of its own species, or of course another species, into adulthood. It's kind of a juvenile characteristic that some parts of the population have adapted to keep into adulthood. So milk is always kind of a weird thing. We've got an episode coming up on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, another show that we do about dairy and livestock in general. So do check it out if you'd like to learn more. So if you're keeping a checklist at home here, folks, Nikola Tesla was kind of right about tobacco, but to Noel's point, he did not anticipate the differing delivery methods. He was totally wrong about coffee. He was right about alcohol. And the sci-fi writers so far are, what would you say? I would say they're kind of right.
They're pretty close to alternatives. Right. Yeah. Look, they're like you said, Ben, a lot of these predictions are said with a sort of extreme authority that is hard to give full credit to. You know, they're basically saying, like, society is going to completely pivot to this means of sustenance. And as we know, you know, people like all kinds of different things. I have to say, I think we buried the lead slightly. I love the term pseudo-steak. Mm-hmm. I wish that would have taken off. Instead, we just call it, what, seitan? Seitan, I think, is the closest thing to pseudo-steak. And mock turkey, which I guess would be something like tofurkey. But I'm a big fan of the Impossible Burgers, not because I'm like anti-meat. I just think they taste really good. And the fact that they bleed, quote unquote, which is sold as a feature, not a bug, I think is very strange. But that's not what makes me like it. But I think we have gotten to a place where you have a lot more options now. But it's certainly not something that society as a whole has gravitated towards and, like, you know, dumped everything, right? Dumped everything else.
Right. Yeah. It's sort of like, you know, the rise of the ebook or the Kindle did not kill the physical book and probably won't for a very long, long time. These things can exist without being mutually exclusive. The real question is one of price. And in parts of the world for a very long time, beef was itself a luxury. It's still a luxury in many parts of the planet. So the alternative meat stuff is interesting. I love it. Some listeners know I was a vegetarian for a long time, a number of years ago. I am no longer a vegetarian. I'm omnivorous. But yeah, man, get down on an Impossible Burger if you haven't tried one. They're pretty solid. I would say they taste good. But bean burgers taste good too. I had one just a few weeks ago.
And I think, Ben, both of us being fans of home cooking, I think we can both attest to, like, it's sort of a misnomer that, like, oh, if you eat vegetarian food, then it's, like, flavorless or bland or something. That's only if you, like, don't know how to cook or don't know, you know, don't have a good recipe. Because everything that when you're cooking, it's all about how you season it. It's all about the ingredients you use. You can make vegetarian food taste incredible. There's just so much flavor possibility in vegetarian food. Which leads us to our next point, that many of these forward-thinking minds of the time believed that fruits and vegetables would be a big deal, would be absolutely huge, let's call it, in the 21st century. You know, for a lot of reasons. A, they're sustainable. You can grow them yourselves and you can keep, you know, tend to them, and you don't have to put all these I mean, obviously there's water consumption issues to think about, but in general, it seems like a little bit more of a long game that we as a human species could sustain, much more so than the beef problem, which we know has all kinds of issues beyond just humanitarian, but just about the methane that's produced and all of the, you know, conditions in farms. And, you know, we don't have to get into all that stuff like the Upton Sinclair meatpacking industry stuff, but it is rife with potential problems, whereas fruits and vegetables, none of that ick factor really comes into play. So in 1900, you had someone named John Elforth Watkins Jr., who wrote in the Ladies Home Journal that we would be eating strawberries, raspberries, and blueberries, quote, as large as apples, and peas and beans would be as big as beets, he says.
Yeah. Now, okay, let's pause for a second because we have to understand the concerns about what are called GMOs, short for genetically modified organisms, didn't really exist in the 1900s. A century ago, that wasn't something that people were super concerned about. I also have to point out, whenever GMOs come up, things that we eat before the concern of GMOs, like corn, they were already genetically modified through breeding. So it's a weird term. They weren't worried about this. They did predict, as you said, an extreme version of a trend that is occurring. It's not hard to find really, really big fruits. We know that because there's a lot of pretty solid science put into creating strains of things like seedless fruits, right? Or things that are larger than the fruit you would find in the wild. But some folks even went further and they brought the atomic age into the mix.
Gotta love a good atomic age prediction. And I love that they do this without batting an eyelash or considering that maybe you shouldn't eat those basketball-sized tomatoes that were caused to be that way because of fallout left behind by the hydrogen bomb. There's really no cautionary kind of spirit in any of these predictions. There was an article in 1956 from the Independent Press Telegrams magazine called Southland, where a gentleman by the name of George Servais comes up with this whole notion of a farm from the year 2000. In the year 2000, when hydrogen bombs would cause the soil to produce 3-foot-long carrots, 4-foot-wide turnips, and the aforementioned basketball-sized tomatoes.
Mm-hmm. Ah, and what if those tomatoes weren't just basketball-sized, but what if they were also square? Former Agricultural Secretary Orville Freeman believed that the mechanization of agriculture would lead to a more efficient production, and that a knock-on effect of this would be the creation of square tomatoes. Now, he's not totally wrong. He just got the wrong plant, because you can today, or when they're in season, you can buy square watermelons and square melons of several different types in places like Japan. This is true. They are more expensive. But I love one of the arguments for the square produce folks, and it's this. They said they'll be better. They'll be better on sandwiches.
Yeah, because I just know nothing I hate more than a round tomato on a square sandwich. I need the edges to perfectly align so that every bite gives me a perfect combination of the ingredients.
We already have round bread.
Yeah, but round bread just seems wrong, Ben. That just seems wrong, Ben. I got to back up 2 clicks. How do they do those square melons, man? Do they grow them in a box or something? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty low level technology. It's clever, though. I'll send you the link. They grow them into those frames, into those shapes, but they're purely ornamental, and they're often like the equivalent of $100 or so. People pay out the nose for melons.
Do you guys, Casey, I'm going to ask you first, since you haven't chimed in this episode yet, do you remember the early internet meme hoax thing by the name of Bonsai Kitten?
Oh, absolutely. I remember the Bonsai Kitten.
Tell us about Bonsai Kitten, Casey.
And I actually was not aware that this was like a hoax. So I'm glad, because that was like kitten cruelty. It was basically a kitten that had been stuffed into kind of like a square glass container, right? Mm-hmm. And
yes,
that's pretty much all there is to it.
Yes. Yeah. You grow your kitty in a square clear glass container, and it molds around so it becomes like a perfectly cubed kitten. All for the kawaii of it all.
So back to these predictions. Luckily, yes, Bonsai Kitten, for anyone familiar, is a hoax. I've got to check in here. Casey, what's your take on the alternative meat field, or on the alternative protein field in general?
I think it's a worthwhile field of study. I've had like some Impossible Burgers, that kind of thing. They're fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, I am a meat eater, but I also enjoy kind of trying the new stuff. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, the meat substitutes thing seems like a reasonable thing to me.
Would you eat insects?
No, probably not. this has become like an internet meme, right? Like, eat the bug, stay in the pod.
I don't know about this. I would definitely eat the bug if it was one of those crunchy little cricket boys.
I could see like a deep fried chocolate dipped kind of thing, maybe. Yeah. To just like mask the taste so you don't really even notice. I would do that on a lark, but not as like a steady part of my diet.
What if you knew a false burger patty was made up of ground up locusts or something, but it wasn't buggy in texture? Would you be okay with that?
Yeah, why not? Sure, yeah. I would try it anyway. Yeah.
I just read the ingredients after dinner.
Exactly, so, yes.
So Noel, what about you? Just a second ago, you said you were down with eating our insectoid friends.
Big time. And like I just said, especially, I think, I know there are ways where you can grind them up to make, you know, different textures in, you know, meat substitute products. And I think that would be an interesting use of insects. And I know they add a lot of protein and they have a lot of kind of a nutty flavor. And I know that sounds gross to say that bugs have a nutty flavor, but I'm okay with it. I'm on board. I have never had opportunity, though, to eat a cricket, but I would do it.
So you guys might remember, me and a friend of the show, Lauren Vogelbaum, we've eaten several insects on our old show, Snack Stuff, including crickets in three different flavors, ate some locusts. Oh, I've had some beetles before. I ate not maggots, grubs. I ate grubs from Korea, and they tasted the way that tires smell on a hot day, which is a very synesthetic way to describe those. But I bring this up because the UN predicted that people will start eating bugs as part of their standard diet to help save the planet or save the ecosystem. The thing is, a lot of people aren't catching on. And, you know, understandably, I think that squeaks people out. But maybe kelp, maybe seaweed is a more acceptable substitute. What do you think?
Well, as a big sushi eater, I'm absolutely fine with seaweed. I really like a good seaweed salad. Kelp is a little bit burlier, I think, than just regular old seaweed, if I'm not mistaken. Like, it's a little thicker, and like, it's the kind of stuff where if you're wading out of the ocean, you get it caught on your feet, and it has like these weird little kind of like buoy things that hang off the sides, sort of look like octopus tentacles. That stuff does squig me out a little bit, but apparently quite sustainable and pretty good in a salad. And there were predictions that by the Rand Corporation that in 1966, in an effort to promote eating more kelp, they predicted that in the future, massive underwater fields of kelp and other varieties of seaweed would be kept by underwater farmers, aka frogmen, one of our favorite terms from Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. You often hear about spies, Russian spies wearing scuba gear being referred to as frogmen. I always think of the opening to Johnny Quest, where you see the particularly froggy-looking frogmen wearing the green scuba suits. But yeah, this notion that you could take this kelp, which is very rich in protein, and make it taste like anything you want, like Willy Wonka style.
Yeah, it's almost a it's almost a gobstopper, right? The schnozberries taste of schnozberries. Mm-hmm. But don't worry, this prediction is still coming to pass. And like you said, Noel, you can find protein-rich kelp in a couple of different applications now. Maybe not as extreme as the Rand Corps once imagined in 1966, but we assure you, folks, we've looked into it. And eating kelp is not going to lead you down some sort of terrible Veruca Salt Oh, no, wait. It wasn't Veruca Salt. What was her name? She was always chewing gum.
Violet Beauregard.
Violet Beauregard will not lead you down a Violet Beauregard path. You won't be rolled out blueberry-sized, or you won't turn into an enormous piece of kelp.
Quickly back to the frogmen, though. This prediction, which didn't come to pass, I would love to see this happen, this notion of an underwater farm maintained by these scuba men, and that they would live in these, like, underwater bunkers for, like, weeks out of the year while they tended to their crop. That prediction kind of kept going. This idea of living subterraneanly, like either underground or underwater. Isaac Asimov, another fantastic thinker, thought that in order to conquer, I guess, what he would maybe see as like the inevitable annihilation of the above ground planet and the atmosphere and such, perhaps we'd do a better job of setting up underground cities. Very post-apocalyptic stuff, using advanced light technology that could create the same quality of light as you'd have outdoors, and then just use the Earth's surface for agriculture and grazing ground and parks. Not quite as bleak as I was getting at, but he definitely didn't quite land that one on the bullseye, did he?
Well, not maybe not yet. There are underground facilities that are the size of small towns, but they are almost entirely like bunkers for some above ground disaster. They're not fun places yet. There are a couple of things that are temporary. They're like tangentially related. There are some fantastic undersea hotels you can go to in Singapore, Dubai, the Caribbean, that let you get a get the feel of living life beneath the waves. And I believe there's a plan in New York to create an underground park called the Low Line, sort of an alternative to the High Line, right?
Yeah, the High Line is like the kind of mixed use kind of area in New York that's part park, part like shopping district, and it's all made, if I'm not mistaken, out of like disused railway lines, sort of like the Beltline is here in Atlanta. But yeah, they have sort of a subterranean alternative to it that I have not heard much about. I don't believe it's debuted yet, but it's called the Low Line, and it would be like kind of like a similar like underground kind of mixed use shopping and dwelling kind of situation.
You don't have to be a mole person or a frogman to apply. Another urban prediction that I thought was really interesting, and it's Asimov is one person who predicted this, but many other people, not just in the realm of science fiction, have predicted this. It's the emergence of the megacity, the megapolis, right? He thought that he was looking at the growth of Boston and Washington and DC, and he said, you know, eventually these things are going to run into each other. Mm-hmm. They're going to be one huge just city that doesn't stop. And I think we're well on the way to that.
I guess so. But my question is sort of like, to what end? Like, is it out of, efficiency? So you just have one government? Like, it gets to a point where if it becomes big enough and it's all just mushed together, then is there really even a need for local government versus, like, federal government? So, like, the whole point of, like, you know, the United States is that we've got different cities and states, obviously, that are kind of governed independently. And if you start just kind of mashing them all together, you sort of lose some of that individuality. I just wonder, what was he thinking as to what benefit this would have?
You know, it may not have been a question so much for him of benefits as one of inevitability, that the suburbs and exurbs that keep expanding and are continually constructed
kind of blur.
Eventually blur. And that's sort of happening. And if the trends continue, it may well be that the distinction between Boston and DC becomes increasingly a matter of tradition. I don't know. I think locals will tend to want to keep their governments, though. There might be something that exists that's like the Great Eastern Seaboard conglomeration or something like that, but they'll still want, you know, the mayor of Boston is still going to want to be the mayor of Boston, you know?
Sure. And, you know, as much as people maybe like rag on their local politicians, at least they feel like they have some agency, you know, and they're somehow different from people that live in other cities, and that they have their own like unique kind of personality and like culture. I think that's really important. So I am not a fan of this prediction. And I hope it's not as inevitable as Asimov thought. I am a big fan of this next one.
I want to speak a little bit or talk a little bit about the presumed kind of science behind it. This idea, of course, it was Robert A. Heinlein who wrote, the one about Mars. He had like a series of books about traveling to Mars and setting up colonies on Mars. And I know it has Mars in the name, and I am forgetting the name entirely, but you guys can look it up, Google that. But he believed that there would, should, and would be nursing homes on the moon. And that was because he thought that living on the moon, where gravity is just 17% of the gravity found on Earth, would actually slow down the aging process. He thought that, like, you know, older bodies that were deteriorating, having frail joints, they would feel less pain. Their weak hearts wouldn't have to work so hard. And I guess, you know, people always say gravity is your worst enemy in terms of aging, because everything goes down, you know, everything sags and all of that stuff. And like you're constantly being pulled towards the center of gravity. What do you think, Ben? Does that hold true, or does this sound like some science fiction-y thinking?
Oh, my repressed childhood astronaut is coming out here. First, I think are you talking about Red Planet?
Red Planet, exactly, correct.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. He also wrote Starship Troopers.
That's right.
Cool dude. But yeah, to your point, man, it's a nice idea, and it's a laudable one, and I think it's cool that he is keeping older patients or members of the human species in his thoughts, but it doesn't consider radiation. It doesn't consider the inevitable degradation of the musculature if we keep people on the moon in low gravity environments for such a long time. It would be a one-way ticket if they lived there for a long time. And maybe we can create the technology that would allow people to live in space for an extended period. But interestingly enough, to bring this part one of our two-part series back around just a bit, the best chance for people to live long-term on the moon is still going to be living under the surface, because that lunar rock will shield them from the radiation of the cosmos.
Well, Ben, we also haven't talked about how your childhood internal astronaut might bring up this point too. You got to be in tip-top peak shape to even make that voyage to the moon. You know, so what would that be like to send some elderly folks that are frail in the first place, and what impact would that have on their bodies just to even get there? Would it maybe set them back? You know what I mean? Like, I see your point about the radiation. Like, there's all these other mitigating factors that maybe would work against this, like, miracle cure of living in, like, lower gravity. And if not, can't we recreate low gravity conditions here on Earth?
Yes. Yes, we can. Can we create the... Wow, you like how I'm such a propagandist for this? Yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
Right now, our trouble would be recreating those conditions for a long period, for years and years and years. That is a little bit more difficult for us. But I think it's worthwhile. How cool would it be if a few decades from now, we could get together and just, instead of saying, hey, let's all go on a road trip, or hey, let's all go visit Japan or something, we could say, hey, let's go visit the lunar base. Another thing I think needs to be considered in this equation is think of your loved ones. Think of the folks in your life who might potentially benefit from living on the moon. They would be very far away, and it would be tough for you to see them. You know, you would be on lunar Zoom calls. So it might not work for everyone, but gosh, man, I don't know. Would you do it? Would you guys do it? Would you go to the moon? Let's say you were in like you're in your mid 80s. You're in pretty good condition, but age is catching up with you. Would you go to the moon and live there if it meant you could live to 120?
Sure.
Yeah, why not?
I'm guess. This is that same thing we talked about, Ben. This idea of making a New Year's resolution or thinking about your future self. My present self gives my future self, you know, all the support that I can muster to go to the moon. But my future self might not feel the same way. But we'll see. We'll see. We'll see if I even get to my mid-80s to even make that call. And who knows? By the time we're in our mid-80s, maybe this will be an option. Maybe a lot of these things will have come to pass that we are now poo-pooing as like, you know, because what is a great forward-thinking, you know, predictive mind if not someone that is constantly being told, ooh, you missed the mark on that one, only to like 10 years later things do go that way. So I don't know. A lot left to be written about some of these predictions. Maybe underwater kelp farming. We're going to get into some really fun underwater stuff in the next episode that we're not going to spoil right now, involving water sports and modes of transportation.
That's correct. And speaking of our future selves, let's put some more pressure on those guys. Look, folks, the future host of Ridiculous History of this next episode that you're going to hear in just a little while, they're going to do a bang up job. It's going to be amazing. You're going to leave feeling like you went on that ride at Epcot. I think it was Epcot, where you go through these different versions of the future.
Is that Spaceship Earth? No.
Maybe it was.
I don't remember.
I just remember at the very end, you could check. Someone write in and let us know what this is. At the very end of this ride, you could choose how to end the ride. You could fly underwater or through space or the desert or something like that. Let us know. We want to know what you think of these predictions. We want to know your other favorite predictions from yesteryear about the 21st century. And if you're feeling frogman-y, then take a leap and let us know your predictions for the future. I want to tell you guys these things, you say, shouting into the void, waving your fist in the air, but I don't know how to get in contact with you. Well, we can fix that right now.
Yeah, first of all, stop shouting and lower your fists. This is a safe space. You can reach us on the internet very easily. No void shouting necessary. You can find us on our Facebook group. It's called The Ridiculous Historians. All you have to do is name a name, my name, producer Casey Pegram's name, Ben Boland's name, anyone associated with the show that we list in those ubiquitous credits that we do at the end of every episode. A topic, anything that lets us know that you're an actual human person who's a fan of the show and you're in. Lots of great meme sharing, lots of good conversations. Maybe some other predictions. I would love to see that. You can also find us on the various social media outlets of your choosing. We're on Facebook as just like a page. We're on Instagram. We're also available as individual human people. You can find me on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown.
Send your weird predictions or weird retrofuturism stuff to me directly on Twitter or on Instagram. I'm at Ben Bolin on Instagram. I'm at Ben Bolin, HSW on Twitter. As always, thanks to our super producer, the man of the hour, the man of the future, dare I say, Casey Pegram. Thanks to Alex Williams, who composed this banging track. Thanks to our own Nikola Tesla, the one, the only Gabe Lussier.
Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit. Eve's Jeff Coates, check out her new show that she's executive producing, J.Ill, the podcast featuring the one and only Jill Scott. Also, a daily show that Eve's does called This Day in History Class. Jonathan Strickland, the quizster, I believe he's due for a New Year's appearance any day now. No spoilers, but I just have a feeling.
We always say that, but we mean it.
We do really mean it. And thanks to you, Ben. Happy New Year, my friend. It's good to be back on the Zoom with you again.
And Happy New Year to you, Noel. Here's to many more episodes and New Year's in the future.
We'll see you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.